ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Excuse me. I woke up at 2:30 this morning. I started thinking about work and I couldn't get back to sleep. So I just got out of bed at 3:30 and started my day. I'm going to pay for this at work today, though. Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. If lying awake at night mentally going through your to-do list is familiar to you, don't fret. We have sleep experts on hand. Moira Junger is the CEO of the Sleep Health Foundation and a sleep psychologist. Charlotte Gupta is a sleep expert specialising in shift work and a senior postdoctoral research fellow at the Appleton Institute CQ University. Hello to you both.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
So, Moira, do we know how many workers are not getting enough sleep?
In terms of Australians not getting enough sleep, we know that probably about 50% last night would say they didn't get sufficient sleep. Of that 50%, half would be because of workload and busy mind and or just their general aches and pains. And the other half would be like a sleep disorder or a mental health condition or some kind of physical actual diagnosis.
The word insomnia, is that an official term and so we should be quite careful how we use it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really, you notice I probably just said they're insufficient sleep or inadequate sleep. Good pick up. Insomnia, we use it as it's an actual condition with set criteria, diagnostic criteria, and depending on the classification system, it's usually been many, many, many months, like, you know, 3 months, 6 months plus. And it's most nights of the week that you have difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep. And the most important thing is it's despite adequate opportunity and that it causes marked distress and marked impairment in your occupational functioning or social functioning. So it's quite sort of set criteria. So of those 50% I was talking about, maybe 15% have chronic insomnia.
So how much sleep in terms of quantity are we meant to be having?
International recommendations for most adults, we say that, you know, between 7 and 9 hours of sleep is required. But there's a recognition that anything between like 6 or so and even up to 10 or so might be normal for some people. And also there's a real recognition that it doesn't have to be in one go. And that duration of sleep is not the only domain that we think is important. I think there's, you know, this timing of sleep, the quality of sleep, the consistency of sleep, those sorts of domains, and also those subjective things I was talking about, you know, how if it's affecting your functioning, if you're causing distress or all those sorts of things.
So, Moira, is the interaction then between work and sleep a bit of a sleeper issue as far as policy goes?
Well done. It is. I think our time is coming. You know, it's there in plain sight in terms of the recommendations that we have at a policy level. We had a parliamentary inquiry into sleep health awareness back in 2018. The recommendations were there in 2019. There's lots of recommendations around the workplace. There's lots of recommendations now in terms of psychosocial risk in the workplace and that people are much more aware of the sort of modifying that, assessing for risk, reducing risk. And sleep is one of those things, but it's been forgotten a little bit because it's just not well understood yet. It's relatively new. It's not policy level, it's not in strategies, and we just know that sleep needs to make its way in and it's coming.
Now, Moira, the Sleep Health Foundation commissioned a study into work and sleep called Asleep on the Job in 2017.
Yes.
What were the overall findings?
That was incredible. We thought, wow, this is our time. You know, we found that Deloitte Access Economics helped us do that. We commissioned them to do the report and they found that that year alone, like 2016 to 2017, that inadequate sleep cost the nation $66.3 billion in 1 year alone in terms of lost productivity and direct and indirect health costs. And the recommendations were landed down, like the first three are really a lot to do with the workplace and just awareness in general and making sleep a national priority, all sorts of great things. But then COVID hit in 2020, of course, and so every level of government, rightly so, had to put their focus onto that. But we're building the case again. And we know from our counterparts in climate change and in smoking and in seatbelts and in mental health itself, we know that it takes decades to sort of to get the awareness and the change that's required.
If you did this again, would it uncover anything new?
I think it'd be worse if we did it now, and we're about to do something big again, like a big national study like this. I think that the lost productivity and the health costs and the recognition of how many people are suffering with inadequate sleep, well, I think we'd find it even higher. And I know that personal sustainability, that we talk a lot about the sustainability of the planet, I think we really urgently need to see that sleep is a core pillar of health and a core pillar of our personal sustainability, like adequate rest, adequate restorative sleep is just as important as diet and exercise, and yet it just hasn't had the recognition yet at the policy and government level.
Charlotte, what do we know about the impact of work on sleep?
Unfortunately, a lot of the time work is negatively impacting our sleep. So whether that's the amount of time we have for sleep, so non-standard work hours that are impacting when we can go to sleep and the timing we have for sleep for shift workers that have to sleep during the day. And then also the stress aspect of work and remote work. So all of these different factors coming together to sort of stars aligning to really make sure we're not getting the sleep we need.
And what happens to our brains and the way we work when we don't get enough sleep, Charlotte?
We've all had the sort of the Monday blues experience where you wake up on a Monday morning and you probably haven't had enough sleep because you've slept in on the Sunday, and then it's harder to go to sleep earlier Sunday night, harder to wake up early for work on Monday, and we're feeling irritable and harder to get out of bed. And those are the feelings we get when we're in the laboratory and we sleep deprive people. That's what we see. So mood is worse, we're more irritable. So that part of our brain, the amygdala, that's the emotional centre of our brain, has amplified reactivity when we're getting poor sleep. And so we're more likely to react negatively to stimuli. So we're more likely to be in a bad mood and perceive things as stressful when we haven't had a bad sleep. Our work performance can be worse, so both cognitively, where we're not reacting as quick to things, and then also physical performance, so we're more likely to have workplace accidents when we're not getting enough sleep. The commute is a lot more risky, so we're more likely to be in a near miss or a crash if we haven't had enough sleep. So it's really impacting all aspects of our lives.
Charlotte, how is the rise in working at home affecting our sleep?
Yeah, there's probably good and bad aspects to it. So it's not that it's all a problem. So some of the good aspects are, you know, being able to have more time for physical activity has come out in the research with the rise of remote work. Some people are able to have more time for sleep and prioritise it more because there's, you know, not the commute, and so they can sort of stop work and start their sleep routine. But for a lot of people, it's been a problem where the lines between work and home and sleep are blurred, and people are working a lot later into the evening because there isn't that stopping point where you have to stop and drive home. Having kids at home during COVID also really impacted work-life routines. And so for a lot of people, it was impacting both the time they had for sleep and then also increasing stress, which worsens sleep quality.
Moira, to what extent should employers be responsible for workers' sleep?
It's a good question. I think that there is a definite two-way street. There is obviously individual responsibilities and a very big responsibility of the workplace to provide adequate conditions for not only breaks in between work hours, etc., as well as just safe commutes and understanding people's need to report if they are sleep deprived. And we're not talking only shift work or heavy vehicles. Like even if you're in a small car and you're not a shift worker, just being aware of the risks of sleep deprivation and what that can do, all those things that Charlotte's just outlined.
Charlotte, we know that shift work can have a bad effect on sleep. And when it comes to work, this is a well-researched area. For people who work non-standard hours, can you give us some recommendations, please?
Yeah, so really around one in two of us are working some form of non-standard hours, whether that's shift workers, so emergency services, healthcare, mining, truck driving. But then there's also the rise of gig workers, so your Uber driver or Uber Eats driver that's sort of working late in the evening, students, new parents, everyone's almost doing sort of some form of shift work. And it's really disruptive to our sleep. So we're sleeping at different timing throughout the week, and light is really impacting how well we can adapt to those rhythms. So even if we did multiple night shifts in a row, it's really hard to adapt to it because we're coming home from our shift when we want dark because it's our sleep time, but it's during the day, so we've got light. Our research team has put together some sleep hygiene tips specifically for shift workers. So we've got a website, healthyshiftwork.com.au, and we have sleep hygiene tips. So the things that we all usually hear about, so like a sleep environment, caffeine, those sorts of things, but tailored for shift workers. And then also tailoring your sleep environment as best you can. Blocking out light is really key for shift workers.
Charlotte, one in two doing some kind of shift work. That seems really high. Has that changed a lot?
Yeah, really increasing. But almost all of us, so one in two, are sort of working some form of non-standard hours, whether that's, you know, remote work, homework, where you're working later into the evening, and that's non-standard in that it's impacting our sleep. If we're working later in the evening, we've then got to change all of our routines around that. New parents, we considered doing a form of non-standard work, very hard work, and impacting your sleep routines. Uni students that are staying in the libraries all night, so yeah, doing shift work. A lot of people don't think of themselves as shift workers, but if you're doing a form of work outside of that 9 to 5 and it's impacting your sleep, we would consider it non-standard work hours.
Now, Charlotte, you're also researching nutrition and sleep. What have you found so far?
There's a huge relationship between what we eat and how we sleep, and it sort of goes both ways, where we've all had that experience of not having enough sleep, and when we're feeling tired and sleepy, we want to reach for those potentially more delicious but more harmful foods, so our chocolates and our sweet and the delicious things that keep us going.
Hot chocolate.
Improving our mood as well. But then vice versa, so what we eat can impact our sleep. So looking at the types of foods we're eating, so melatonin is present in some foods. And so if you're wanting to improve your sleep, then having things like tart cherry juice is really high in melatonin, not as delicious as some other things, but also milk, nuts, particularly pistachios, oily fishes, so salmon, sardines, oats, eggs. So things that were sort of might already be in your diet, not necessarily going out to buy something special, but just being mindful of having those foods, and particularly, I guess, in your dinner meal. But then the key is to not have that dinner meal too close to sleep. So still having time between your last meal and sleep timing.
Moira, let's get some advice now on sleep treatments. We're not talking about clinical sleep disorders here, though. So how do you know if you should go and see a doctor?
If your sleep is inadequate, you're feeling like you're not satisfied with your sleep, you think you can't get to sleep despite adequate opportunity, I think you should try self-help for some time, like many, many weeks. You could try looking at the Sleep Health Foundation website for a range of different fact sheets that are free and evidence-based, so sleephealthfoundation.org.au. And if it hasn't sort of improved, being able to assess whether it's affecting your functioning, like is my quality of life being affected? Am I being really distressed by this? Then you actually need to just talk to your GP in the first instance. We know that a lot of healthcare professionals in Australia don't have adequate training with sleep. That hasn't been in the curriculum, and that's being changed at the moment. And we're sort of doing that. The Australasian Sleep Association have got a couple of grants, which is really great, looking at educating doctors, primary care, nurses, psychologists, pharmacists. There's a whole lot of people being targeted at the moment to get better information, because we know that non-drug treatments are the best as well. Like even if you have sleeping medication, it's just meant to be short-term or intermittent. It's not really the gold standard for sleeping issues. So I think there's a lot of self-help things you can do around just that, being very aware of the effects of light and dim light conditions. That's a big one. Being able to prioritise sleep is a really big one. It sounds like a bit of a motherhood statement, but just understanding that sleep's really important and making room for it. Then trying to understand what you think the problems are, like identifying the cause of the issue, is going to be the first thing you can do, because a lot of people look for buying products or taking a certain supplement and all those sort of things. So searching under rocks for the
magic pill.
Yeah, some kind of magic pill, but it's probably most likely going to be more something in you, like just your prioritisation, delegation, asking for help, getting your workload sorted. Those sorts of things are one of the first things you can do. Taking away the stress of not sleeping, like coping with the understanding that all of us, including someone like me who considers themselves a sleep expert, both professionally and in life, really good sleeper generally, I have poor nights. You know, sometimes you do have poor nights and you've got these other, you know, caring responsibilities and things that you do have to roll with it sometimes. So not aiming for perfection, those sorts of things, and then seeking help.
Must be a lot of pressure on you being a sleep expert to actually get enough sleep, Maura. That must keep you up at night. Charlotte, for the rest of us workers who might be experiencing fatigue and disrupted or poor quality sleep, what should we be doing at night to prepare ourselves for a good night in bed?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and a lot we can do. It's often hard to tackle the thing at work that's giving us stress or that's causing us to get poor sleep. And so, especially when we know a stressful period's coming up, making sure we're giving ourselves the best chance to get the best sleep. And like Maura was saying, it's about giving ourselves that chance to get a really good sleep. And no, we might not be able to, but trying and giving ourselves that ability. So bedtime environment, so having a nice comfy bed, managing light if it's coming through, so with an eye mask or blackout blinds, only using bed for sleep and intimacy, so not having your laptop out in bed, not checking your emails on your phone, making sure we're not associating bed with anything other than sleep. But really, your bedtime routine ideally should start sort of in the 2 to 3 hours before we're actually in bed. So making sure we're winding down, we're reducing light in the evening. So even if you're sitting on the couch watching TV, even if you do have to be working late and doing some emails on the couch, making sure the bright lights aren't on. But really getting into that bedtime routine, treating ourselves like we would a baby. So we have wind down routines for babies before we put them down to a nap. Really doing that for ourselves, treating ourselves as that baby that needs that wind down, getting into that routine.
Is there anything that we can do during the work day then, Charlotte, that will help us sleep better at night?
Yeah, caffeine is probably a big one. As much as we want to reach for caffeine in the afternoons, particularly if we've had a bad night's sleep the night before, really trying to avoid caffeine in the 8 hours before bed. So some colleagues, Carissa Gardner, did a review looking at or how late in the day we can have caffeine where it still has an impact on sleep. And 8 hours, it was still having this impact on our sleep at night. So really cutting back, aiming for caffeine earlier in the day. Those foods that I mentioned earlier, so if you are having a dinner meal, having those foods richer in melatonin. Our physical activity during the day, that's also going to promote healthy rhythms that help us sleep, getting light during the day. I mean, I'd love to be able to say tackle work stress, but that's obviously easier said than done. But also if we've got a stressful day, being kind to ourselves and knowing that, okay, it might be tougher for me to get to sleep tonight, or I'm probably going to be lying in bed thinking about that meeting that I had today. So I'm going to be kind to myself and I'm going to maybe play a podcast or be proactive in doing things to help you get to sleep.
Charlotte, some of us get anxiety about how much sleep we're getting or not getting, as the case may be. Are sleep timing devices a useful tool in that case?
Yeah, they can be. I think if we're anxious about going to sleep and how much sleep we're getting, so watching the clock is really common, and I do this as well, knowing I shouldn't, but, you know, checking your clock and going, okay, if I get to sleep now, I'm going to have this many hours of sleep. Oh no, I still haven't gotten to sleep. Now I'm only going to get this much time for sleep. It's an awful sort of trap that we fall into. And the main thing is really, if you're someone that's prone to doing that, I would avoid any sort of device that's looking at the timing of sleeping. And it's really about knowing that if we don't get enough sleep, sure, we've talked about all of the really negative effects of that, but as a one-off, we've all coped with not a lot of sleep. We've all had, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep and gone to work the next day, and it might not have been the greatest day we've ever had. It might not have felt the best, but we've coped. And so you're better off sort of lying in bed. If you're lying in bed and can't sleep and watching the clock, even getting out of bed and going to sit on the sofa and read, or just sort of relaxing yourself, not thinking about sleep, is the best thing to do rather than really fixating on the timing.
What's your number one tip to get your mind off work and have a good night's sleep? Moira.
Making sure it's a priority, knowing that sleep is the core pillar of our physical and mental health. And I've been around health for a really long time, like 36 years at the coalface, both as a nurse and as a psychologist. And I do think, and I think then the research supports this, that it is a highly modifiable thing. Once you've got the right information and the right attitude to it, and reduce your anxiety and stress and preoccupation with perfection around sleep, and you get the right information, just recognising that it is a priority, and yeah, don't aim for perfection.
Thank you both.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
Moira Junger is the CEO of the Sleep Health Foundation and a sleep psychologist. Dr. Charlotte Gupta is a senior postdoctoral research fellow at the Appleton Institute at CQ University. And next up in Try This, some more sleep tips, this time from some of you. Time for Try This with Alex Sweetman, the senior program manager of the Australasian Sleep Association. Alex, some of us have trouble getting to sleep, and some others of us, well, we wake up in the middle of the night and we think about work. What's going on there?
Yeah, so broadly, these are symptoms of insomnia, difficulties falling asleep at the start of the night, or frequent or long awakenings throughout the night. Incredibly common, so 30 to 50% of adults in Australia have at least short-term insomnia symptoms. And about 10 to 15% of us have long-term or something called chronic insomnia disorder.
Now, we put up a post on LinkedIn asking for sleep tips. Can we run some of them past you and get your take on them?
Please, that sounds good.
Yep. Okay, Sarah writes, my number one sleep tip, get up at the same time every day. It made all the difference for me. Alex, your thoughts?
If you tried to narrow it all down to one recommendation, having a relatively consistent wake-up time each day, and then on top of that, getting out and getting some natural bright light in the morning, is probably one of the most helpful things that we can do to start improving our sleep or getting our sleep back on track.
And Alex, can you give us a 60-second summary of bedtime window?
Sure. So I work with two clinical psychologists, and we're really passionate about helping people improve their symptoms of insomnia. So we've developed a self-guided digital program called Bedtime Window. It's a 5-session program that provides something called cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia, the recommended best treatment for insomnia. It does this in an interactive and tailored way. Over the course of 5 sessions, users can enter information about their sleep, wake, and lifestyle information, and then the program starts to provide more and more tailored recommendations. So if people Google bedtime window, you can find some of the scientific evidence, and there's a tool to contact us and get involved in some of our clinical trials and access the program.
Can anyone access it?
Anyone throughout Australia. So we have 5 or 6 ongoing research studies at the moment, and we're trying to make it really freely accessible and as broadly accessible as possible, just to try and increase access to this evidence-based treatment.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Thanks again, Lisa.
That's Alex Sweetman, Senior Program Manager of the Australasian Sleep Association. And if you're interested in Bedtime Window, you can contact them via their website, bedtimewindow.com. Let us know about your experiences balancing work and sleep and what's worked for you by emailing thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app. Tap the heart to follow all of our stories. This episode was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Kerry Dell. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Nam, Melbourne. Until next time, have a good sleep. And watch out for a bonus episode that will drop into your feed midweek with more tips from you and from our sleep expert Alex about how to sleep better.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.